two will be resurrected, brought back to the original form, and of course improved to a point where it will be indestructible, to enjoy the new type of life that will be similar to Gan Eden itself on earth, paradise on earth. The point we were discussing was the fact that this belief, the emunah, belief in Tchiyas HaMeisim, is a basic one. A person is not considered a Jew unless he has this faith. It is not enough, though, to believe that there will take place as Tchiyas HaMeisim. You must also believe that this fact is written in the Teda Shebiksav, the written Teda, aside from being mentioned in the Gemara, the oral Teda. Until now we've had discussions with different rabbis in the Gemara who brought statements from the Chumash, the Torah, to prove this point. Different sentences in the Torah that brought out the point that there will take place Tchiyas HaMeisim. Now, the Gemara asks, why do we have to bring these statements, sentences in the Torah, where we find a hint? It's hinted at the Tchiyas HaMeisim. Of course, the hint is clear enough to be accepted as fact. But why not bring proof from a direct story in the Torah itself? We have the story of Yechezkel HaNavi, Yechezkel the prophet. We find that story in the Navi, in the Torah, where Hashem said to Yechezkel, to revive your memories, those of you who have studied the Navi carefully, Yechezkel HaNavi lived after the era of the regular prophets. He lived during the time that the Jews were already in exile, when the remaining two tribes were exiled to Babel. The Babylonian Empire destroyed the first Holy Temple, exiled the Jews to Babel, and there Yechezkel HaNavi spoke his prophecies. Now at that time, there also lived at the same time four great tzaddikim. Daniel was known for his experience, his adventure in the lion's den, and his three friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Three great tzaddikim who lived through being thrown into a pit of fire. We're going to see the connection to this story soon. The Gemara asks, though, why can't we bring proof of Tchiyas HaMeisim from the story of Yechezkel? Because in Yechezkel we find where Hashem commanded Yechezkel to go to Bikaz Dura, the Valley of Dura. There were a large number of corpses there, many thousands of dead bodies, Jewish corpses, and Hashem commanded him, go to this valley and bring these dead bodies back to life. Command them to rise up, and through a miracle, all these thousands of dead bodies will come back to life. This Yechezkel did, as commanded. They all rose up and came back to life. Before we explain that story in further detail, let's first take the Gemara's question. The Gemara asks, why not bring proof that there will be Tchiyas HaMeisim, or there could be Tchiyas HaMeisim, from the story of Yechezkel? The Gemara answers, because of the fact that there is a debate, controversy, as to whether this story really took place. There are different rabbis in the Gemara who argue this point, discuss it. Most of them say that this was a true story. It really transpired. But there is one rabbi who says that this was not a real living experience. It was only an analogy, a statement made by the prophet to bring out the point that there will come a time when Hashem will bring redemption, a gula, to the Jews. They will rise up, instead of being enslaved, an exile will rise up and return back to their home in Israel. It was only a sort of a poetic type of prophecy. Because there exists this debate, therefore the Gemara says it would rather bring proof from a statement that is accepted by all. What is this debate? One rabbi says that the dead that were brought back to life by Yechezkel actually came back to life. They gave praise to Hashem. that Hashem was Mechaye Mason. He brought back the dead to life. Another rabbi says that in truth this was only an analogy. It was not really something that existed, and this is the one rabbi who disputes this fact, the actuality of the story. Another rabbi says, Yehuda ben Seda says, I testify to the fact that this actually happened because my grandfather left me an inheritance, a pair of tefillin from his forefathers. My grandfather was one of those, was a descendant of one of those whom Yechezkel had brought back to life. And this proves, of course, that it really happened. Many commentaries bring up the point that this was true, but very few of them really remain. Of course, the main point is that these, according to all statements, or most statements, who were these dead bodies? They were actually part of the 10 lost tribes. If they came back to life, and they lived among the rest of the Jews, that means that we have a large number of the 10 lost tribes alive among us. And that is why on that point, they say most of them died out, just a few, a handful remained, and this one rabbi, who didn't say there was one of that handful. I will get to the details on that soon. First, as we said, because of the fact there is a controversy, we cannot bring proof from this point. But the Gemara says, let's examine the story itself. An interesting point, we'll have it much more in detail when we learn the story in the Navi. Certain items that must be clarified now. These dead bodies, as we said, there were thousands of them. How come that they were lying in this valley? How did they get there, and what caused their death? On this too, there is debate. There's one opinion that says that these came from the tribe of Ephraim. And what did they die from? When did they die? These were from the tribe of Ephraim, Jews who were enslaved in Egypt. And they miscalculated. They thought the time to leave slavery was 30 years before Moshe Rabbeinu took the Jews out of Egypt. According to their calculations, they left Egypt without being led out by Moshe Rabbeinu, without a leader, without sanction from heaven, and therefore because they went by force, they traveled across towards Israel, and they were wiped out in a battle. Their bodies remained in this valley after the battle. They did not decay, they did not deteriorate. It remained until the time that Yechezkel HaNavi brought them back to life. It was saved for this express purpose, so that when the time came, the Jews would go out into exile, they'd go into Golis. After the Churban Beis HaMikdash, the Jews would then be encouraged and inspired by seeing that Hashem brings back the dead to life. They can be assured that Hashem will ultimately bring the Jews back from Golis to Eretz Israel to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. Secondly, these bones, these bodies, the bones, that is, were called at some ways Hayaveshes. They were dried, the bones were dried up. Why were they called dried bones? Because of the fact that dried means there is no dampness. There is no juice left to it. There's nothing of value. Dried out means worthless. This refers to the type of people that died. They had no drops of water or dampness or Torah or mitzvahs in them. They were wicked. And yet despite this, despite their wickedness, they were still brought back to life through the power of who was the messenger? Yechezkel HaNavi. He was the prophet of that time, Tzaddik Emes, the holiest Tzaddik. And here we see the power of a Tzaddik Emes. But a Tzaddik has the power to bring the dead back to life. So great is the power of the Tzaddik. We had seen it before in the case of Eliyahu HaNavi, Elisha HaNavi, but that was only one single case, one child in that time. Here it brought a whole tribe back, thousands at one time. One tzaddik has the power to bring so many thousands of corpses back to life, literally to life. In that case then, we can judge from there, for those who might be skeptical of the importance and the heavenly powers that are contained in every tzaddik emes. Take for example Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai Zal. Shimon Yochai Zal, the author of the Zohar HaKadosh, who writes in the Zohar HaKadosh about the greatness of Yechezkel. This prophet Yechezkel was known much more than for the fact he brought back the dead to life, but one vision that he saw. He saw the vision called the Maaseh Merkava. He saw the throne of Hashem. So great was he was able to merit seeing a heavenly sight, this heavenly vision. Of course, he was in a sort of a trance at the time when he saw it, as was in the case of most of these prophets. He was able to visualize a sight that was that sacred, that high, that ethereal, that heavenly. This shows his greatness. Shimon Yochai Zal was one of the greatest rabbis of the Gemara, and speaking about this sight, discusses what section of heaven this site was, where it took place in. And speaking about it, Shimon Yochai Zal says, but we, that is himself, we see above that. We have sights that are much higher than that, a much higher level in heaven. And we are not fit to compare Chas V'Shalom Tzaddikim. We cannot speak about true Tzaddikim and compare them in greatness. But we do see from the words of Shimon Yochai Zal that he was Zelcha, he achieved a greatness that apparently seemed to be higher than Yechezkel HaNavi. So surely we can say then that Shimon Yochai Zal could easily have emulated the act of Yechezkel HaNavi in bringing back the dead to life, and more so, much more so. Let's bring this point into still much sharper focus. Shimon Yochai Zal lived close to 2,000 years ago. Let's go to the Tzaddik Emes closest to our time. Rabbeinu Zal, who lived less than 200 years ago, at a time when miracles were not heard of much. And the question was asked about Rabbeinu Zal, or to Rabbeinu Zal, how come that if Rabbeinu Zal is a Tzaddik Emes, why couldn't he show proof of this by snapping his fingers and having the dead rise up, the living dead? What was so difficult about it since he was the Tzaddik Emes? The answer was, the response was, it is a miracle to bring a dead person back to life, admittedly. Try it and you'll see how hard it is. But there are miracles far greater than that. The miracles Rabbeinu Zal performed make this miracle a very minor and elementary one. Rabbeinu Zal said, to bring a body back to life is much smaller, because a body can easily die. A body has no strength to it. A body dies, brought back to life. It's simple compared to a soul, which is supposed to be indestructible. And when the soul dies, and bring that soul back to life, that's a far greater miracle. Soul dying means, when is a soul considered dead? When a person deserts his faith. A person loses faith in Hashem, loses faith in the Torah, loses faith in his religion, his soul actually experiences death. There walks a person with a body without a soul. There is a living spirit, the same as an animal too. Animal can live, walk, eat, move, but there is no living soul in that person. But take a person like that, a person who has had such a yerida, such a fall, such a drop in faith, and to give life to that soul, to bring that soul back to life, to elevate that soul to its former position, to inject the fluid of faith, of life into that soul, that is the true miracle of Tchiyas HaMeisim. Bring life to a dead soul. And this is what the Ben Azal did. Ben Azal dedicated himself to devoting his teachings to those who had lost their faith, to those who had lost, above all, faith in themselves. They felt they were too far gone, they had dropped too far down to ever be able to come back close to Hashem. It was these that Ben Azal inspired, encouraged, gave them the ischaskus, the desire to come back up again, and he revived them to a point where they actually became tzaddikim. This is the true Tchiyas HaMeisim, and this is the true meaning of Rabbi Nazal's main words when he said, when he promised, any person, he said, will come to my grave, to my tzion, will say the Tikkun HaKlali, I vow, I promise to take that person out of Gehenna, to save him for Gan Eden. That means, simply, in Olam Haba, there's also death. Death and life, interpreted there, means Gehenna is death, Gan Eden, paradise, is life. There, Ben Azal said, I will take the person, his soul, out of Gehenna, bring it to life in Gan Eden. Much more important than that, the Ben Azal meant, not over there. There, again, it's a simple fact, a simple matter. A tzaddik in heaven can easily take his soul from Gehenna and place him in Gan Eden. Every tzaddik can do that. Ben Azal meant was far greater than that. A person comes to my tzion, a person accepts the teachings of Ben Azal, I'll take that person out of Gehenna while he's still alive. That means though his soul is in a state of death, I'll bring that soul back to life while he's alive, give him a new spirit of feeling for religion, he'll become pure again. These are the levels of the tzaddikim amitiyim who have this power of Tchiyas HaMeisim. Here we find in the physical form where Yechezkel the prophet came to this, the Bikas Duda, the Valley of Duda, and there brought about this miracle. Now again, as we said, who were these dead? There are some who say it was the tribe of Ephraim. There are others who say that it was actually part of the two tribes, that the king of Bavel, Nebuchadnezzar, when he destroyed the Beis HaMikdash, the Holy Temple, exiled the Jews, the remaining two tribes from Yerushalayim, and brought them into Bavel. On the way, there were some young Jews, young men, who were very pure, the victims of this exile. They were young men, and tragically, they were very, extremely handsome. So handsome that when the Babylonian women saw these boys marching, these young men, they became infatuated with them, and thereby incurring the jealousy and wrath of their husbands. They spoke of this to the king, and the king ordered that these boys be killed, and then have their bodies trampled on with the horses' hooves until they were crushed, completely crushed. What remained, of course, were just these bones in the Valley of Dura, remained there, not buried, until the time came where Yechezkel HaNavi brought those boys back to life as a lesson to the king, which we'll discuss again a little later. What happened in the actual experience of bringing him back to life, the Gemara says that Hashem commanded Yechezkel issue these orders and they will take place immediately. Order these bones to become joined together. This they did. Now, order the arteries, tendons, and then to be covered with flesh. The flesh to be covered with skin. In this exact order, because this is exactly the opposite, it's like a person removing his clothing. The outer garments first, then the undergarments. Here, when these bodies donned their garments, parts of the bodies, they first became formed, the inner part, the interior, and then the exterior part, the flesh, and finally the skin. And at the end, just as in death, the first thing to leave the body is the spirit, Yechezkel gave the command for the winds to come from all four directions, because the word wind is ruach, same word for spirit. The spirits came and entered into these bodies, they rose up and lived. This was the act of Tchias HaMeisim by Yechezkel HaNavi. The Gemara says this happened simultaneously with the case of Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babel, who conquered the entire world. This was the culmination of his victory, driving the Jews out of Israel. At that time, that part of the story, he had built a large idol, tremendous size idol. He issued orders that every person must bow to this idol. Any person who would not bow to this idol would be thrown into a fiery pit. The fires had been burning for a long time. It reached an intensity where a person would be consumed immediately by this fire if thrown into it. There were three who refused to bow: Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, the three tzaddikim, the friends of Daniel, refused to bow. They were reported to the king. The king ordered them thrown into this fiery pit. There were those who doubted that the fire was real, and the king said, those who doubt whether the fire is really that intense in its heat should test it. They came close to the fire at a distance, but close enough that they were consumed just by the radiance of that heat. Now these three were thrown into the fire. From a very far distance, the king observed this. He watched them, and his mouth opened in amazement. And he said, I see four. Three were thrown into the fire, and I see four walking in this fire. I recognize the first three. The fourth one walking behind them looks like Bar Elikin, like a son of heaven, meaning an angel. There's an angel in this fire too. The Gemara says this was the angel who had prayed to Hashem to allow him to save Avraham Avinu from the fire at the time that Avraham was thrown inside the fire by King Nimrod. And Hashem refused this request. He said to the angel, I cannot allow you to do it because Avraham is one Jew in this world. He is so pure, he is one. And I am one, Hashem said, Hashem Echad. It is fitting that one Hashem save the one Jew. But because you have such a strong desire to save the lives of Tzaddikim, I will allow you to save the lives of three of his descendants in the future. And now, this promise of Hashem came true. He sent this Malach, this angel, to the fire to rescue, to cool the fire for these three. This was a sight that Nebuchadnezzar witnessed. He was amazed by it, and then he sat down to drink. While drinking, to get his mind appeased, it was a sight that boggled the imagination. While drinking, he was drinking from a cup, and suddenly the cup burst, and the cup was made of bone. And the bones flew at his face and began to strike his face, to slap him and strike his face. He was shocked, frightened. He asked, what is this? And he was told, these are the part of the bones that the friend of those three, the prophet Yechezkel, is bringing back to life now in the Valley of Dura. These are part of those bones. You know why they're striking you in the face? To show you what little, how small, infinitesimal you are in power compared to heaven. Because you can't even kill right. You try to kill these young boys you hadn't trampled. You crushed them. Your killing is of no avail. You haven't even got the power to kill, while Hashem, or Havdil, has the power to bring back to life those that are dead. When Nebuchadnezzar heard that, in awe, he began to give praise to Hashem. And he said, how great and mighty is the Hashem of the Jews. began to offer such high words of praise that a malach came down from heaven and struck him in the mouth to stop him from speaking. The Gemara says, why? Because his words of poetic praise were of such beauty that they would have put to shame the beauty of the words of King David in Tehillim. So as not to embarrass, to shame the words of King David, he was stopped from speaking. Well, the Gemara says that we see from here, the words of Nebuchadnezzar, we can see that tzaddikim are greater than malachim. Tzaddikim are greater than angels for a number of reasons. First place, when two people are going together, or a number of people are going together, naturally the greatest one is in the lead. Nebuchadnezzar himself said he saw four people in the fire, three in the front, the fourth one, the angel in the back, in the rear. That means that the angel was of a lower stature, lower in greatness, than the three tzaddikim. That's one proof. Secondly, we find that tzaddikim in the Torah are called Elokim. The Beis Din, the judges, the chief rabbis are called Elokim. A court of Hebrew law is called Elokim. Ad Elokim, Yavod Devashneim, the Pasuk in the Chumash. So the tzaddikim are called Elokim, judges, while the Malach, the angel, is called Bar Elokim, a son of Elokim, which means a next level, a lower step. This too proves that the tzaddikim are greater than the Malachim. Third, we find different cases in the Chumash. The statement says that in the future, the angels will ask the tzaddikim, Ma Paul Kael. Angels are in heaven, very close to Hashem. They hear the word of Hashem before anyone on earth. But in the future, when tzaddikim will take the rightful place, they'll be closer to Hashem than the angels. And if the angels want to know what Hashem is saying, they'll have to ask the tzaddikim who are closer to relate to them the words of Hashem. And this we find too in the case of Moshe Rabbeinu. Way back, when he went up to heaven to receive the Torah, and the Torah at that time was in the possession of the angels of heaven. They refused to surrender the Torah. They said to Hashem, they complained to Hashem, Ma li yelud isha beinenu? What is this son of a mortal doing up here in heaven among us? That's the simple translation. The true translation is, Ma li yelud isha, what is this mortal doing beinenu, between us? What is he doing between us, angels, and Hashem? How did he get closer to Hashem than we are? He's only a mortal being. The answer was, he is a tzaddik. And a tzaddik is higher even than angels. There's a deeper thought in this too. Just a moment, delve into this a little deeper. You want to try to exercise your brains a little. The Zohar Kodesh says, ask a question. There's a pasuk which says Hashem bichachma yosad eretz. Hashem founded the earth with chachma, with wisdom. Konein shamayim betvuna. He created, fastened the heavens with tvuna, with understanding. In other words, the earth was created with chachma, the heaven created with tvuna, with bina. And we know that in the heavenly spheres, the three upper ones, or two of the three, are Chachma and Bina. In fact, in the four letters of Hashem's name, Yud Kei Vav Kei, the letters Yud Kei stand for Chachma and Bina, which means that Yud is Chachma, that's the highest level. The next letter, the first letter, the second of Hashem's name, the first letter Kei, is Bina, the second level. The Chachma is higher, Bina is lower. In that case, as Zohar HaKadosh asks, in order to create, it would seem to us naturally that Hashem would use the higher level of Kedusha to create the heaven with, and the lower level to create the earth with. And yet the Pasuk says Hashem created earth, the lower level of earth, with Chachma, the highest level of holiness, and created heavens with Bina, which is the lower level. exactly the opposite then would be logical. The Zohar HaKadosh goes into a very deep answer, we'll spare you that. We'll give you the simple answer now that would enlighten us in this case. When we refer to heaven and earth, we refer to heavenly beings and earthly beings. In other words, malachim, angels, are heavenly beings. Humans are earthly beings. This pasuk tells us that the earthly beings, though they are earthly, but they are tzaddikim, in holiness, stand much higher than malachim. Angels are heavenly. Tzaddikim are earthly. And yet the tzaddikim on earth are bichochma, a higher level of kedusha. Angels heavenly are bebina, a lower level. This again proves that though angels are heavenly, though angels are pure, they cannot commit sins, they have no physical bodies, there is no evil among them, yet they are lower in greatness and holiness than the tzaddikim on earth. And the Gemara states further that when Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah came out of the fire alive, the Goyim nations then came to the Jews and they began to berate them, to strike them, to reprimand them, and they said to them, these three were pure. They did not bow to the idol that the Nebuchadnezzar had set up. You have a Hashem who is so powerful, who is so great, obviously the creator of heaven and earth, who can overpower the greatest heat, the heat of fire, and can save his loyal and devoted servants. How did you dare to bow to the idol? You have a Hashem who is so great and all-powerful, infinite in greatness, and you lower yourselves to desert Hashem and bow to this idol? This embarrassment was so great for the Jews, there was no answer for it. What could they reply to a question like this? Therefore the Gemara says that Hashem at that moment, when the Goyim made this claim, Hashem wanted to destroy the entire world. Because the Jews deserve destruction, there's no reason to maintain the world any longer. Turn the world into blood. Blood means judgment, heavenly judgment. But then Hashem gazed at Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. The pasuk says, "Vehu omed ben hadasim." Hashem stood among the hadasim, and these tzaddikim cooled the anger of heaven. Now note the word hadasim. Why is it used in this case? You know that Esther, Hamalka, very fitting today was Shushan Purim. Esther Hamalka was called Hadassah. Hadassah, because that's a symbol of purity. These three tzaddikim too were given that same title, Hadassim. Only in this case it was more fitting because Hadassim are kosher. Kosher Hadassim are those when you have three leaves on the Hadass. These three tzaddikim combined had enjoyed this point of being three tzaddikim together on one stem. All three were united, and that one stem, the yesod, the foundation upon which the Jew rests. That foundation is emunah of faith. Without that foundation, a Jew cannot exist. There's no standing uprightness for the Jews. Therefore, they were called the Hadassim, and because of them, that the anger of heaven was cooled, and the world continued to exist. Of course, the question arises, we condemn the Jews for having agreed to bow to the idol, Nebuchadnezzar. Not just condemn them, but we say that the anger came from heaven where they faced destruction. They would have been destroyed. Now, there is a law in the Torah which says that if, chas v'shalom, if God forbid the Jews are faced with the order by a wicked king to give up their faith, their religion, or die for it, naturally it's called Kiddush Hashem. A Jew who dies for his religion is performing the greatest possible act of holiness. But what if he does not have the courage at that moment? He faces death. He is told, bow to this idol, give up your faith, or be shot, or be killed, or be tortured. He doesn't have the courage, and he fails in this test. Instead of dying out of fear, he does commit the sin of avodah zarah, of idol worship. In that case, though he has committed a sin, and ordinarily idol worship carries with it a penalty of death, in this case, because of the fact that he was forced into it through fear of death, he does not receive a death penalty. It's called the mitzvah of Yehoreg v'ayavar. A Jew should rather be killed than to commit the sin of idol worship. But if he was not killed, if he did not give himself up to die for Kiddush Hashem, he does not get a death penalty for it. In that case then, why was there a decision in heaven to destroy all the Jews for this sin? They were forced into it. The answer is that it is true that a Jew cannot be taken to court. Let's say we had the Sanhedrin. He couldn't be brought to court and there sentenced to death if he did worship idols in that case, but he still did merit the death penalty b'day shemayim, from heaven. Heaven would still put him to death. The court did not have the power to do so, but heaven would mete out the death penalty for a crime of that sort. Second reason would be that in this case they were guilty and they deserve a death penalty because they remained where they were. They did have the opportunity to flee. Now, if the Jews are told in advance that on this certain day you either worship an idol or die, and until that day they have a chance to flee, give up their homes, escape, go into exile, leave, and thereby avoid this possible confrontation, this choice, and they do not leave, then they are guilty of willfully remaining to worship an idol. In this case, the Jews did have a chance to leave their homes, to hide out. Of course, they would have lost their belongings, their possessions. That's a small sacrifice. That is expected, that a Jew should give up everything he has for the sake of avoiding idol worship. Because they did not, therefore they deserve the death penalty, even from a earthly court. The Gemara asks, after the story of these three tzaddikim, Banya Mishael and Azariah, who escaped from this pit of fire, they came out of it alive, how come they had proven themselves to be such great tzaddikim? They were willing to go into this pit of fire that was horrible to gaze at. In fact, the wording they spoke, their reply to Nebuchadnezzar, when he ordered them to bow to the idol, they didn't just say, "We respectfully decline." They said to him, "You are a dog, and we don't obey instructions from a dog." An insult like that took a lot of courage, because, of course, he couldn't do more than just burn up the fire. And yet, they showed this extreme courage in the face of such an imminent death, torturous type of death. How come that after this incident, the Torah does not mention their names at all? What happened to them after they came out of this pit of fire? The Gemara answers they are not mentioned because of a very sad fact that when they came out, people flocked to see them. And when they stared at them, there is such a thing as an ayin hara, an evil eye. Evil eye means any person is a potential carrier of this evil eye. Evil eye means a person who possesses a deep degree of jealousy. One looks at someone with jealousy, where he begrudges that person something he has, he automatically transmits this power of evil eye to that person, and he could actually hurt him physically with this evil eye, or even cause his death, depending upon the power of evil in that person. So, these three tzaddikim, as great as they were, but faced with a mass of populace, a multitude of people who looked at them with this ayin hara, they all said, "Wow, what how powerful they are, how great they are, how good they are, how wonderful they are. All these compliments, of course, said begrudgingly, meant that there was an evil eye being placed at them, injected into them, and this caused their passing. So the miracle resulted in a death because of this evil eye. We mentioned many times before that there is a possible defense against this ayin hara. The most important one is one that requires no defense. It's an automatic one. The oras is, of course, that ayin hara exists. It is not a superstition. It's a fact. Today, of course, it is not as strong as it used to be in the olden days, but even today, it does exist in a small form. It is important, though, a person should know, as Abenazal says, it's written in the Gemara, that any person who is born in a family where the oldest one is not a Bechor, where the oldest child is not a boy, the oldest child is a girl, then all children in that family are automatically immune to the power of the Ayin Hara. They cannot be harmed no matter how evil the eye is, no matter what happens, no matter how badly people may begrudge them, but they are immune to the evil eye. It does not mean to say that those who have the oldest, a boy, will become victims of it, chas v'shalom. Certainly not, because there the Gemara says too, there are many exceptions then also. But in this case, though, there is an absolute immunity. Now, these three who died because of the evil eye, that is one opinion. Other rabbis say that they left Bavel, they decided to leave Bavel and go back to Eretz Yisrael to settle there. They did this because they did not want to have any honors bestowed upon them. It was obvious that the king would then appoint them to very high positions. They'd have to live among the Goyim, so they figured rather than do that, they would give up these honors, this wealth, this luxury, and go back to Israel and live there a normal life as tzaddikim should, as a Jew should. The next obvious question, of course, too, is what happened to Daniel? We say that these three tzaddikim did not bow to the idol. They were thrown into the pit of fire. Surely Daniel didn't partake in this evil act. He didn't bow either. How come that we don't find any story of him being thrown in the pit of fire? In fact, nothing is mentioned about him. The story later on about him continuing on the story of Daniel, but nothing to do with this case. Your answer is that he was on a mission sent to Egypt to bring pigs from Egypt for Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon. And why Daniel? He couldn't find a better job than that. The answer is, the Gemara says, it's a matter of side interest, that the Egyptians were very particular about their hogs. They refused to export them, and they were special, like you have for the Virginia ham, special kind. I tell you, Egyptian ham was special, and they didn't want this to be brought out, so they refused to export any hogs that could be reproduced. If they did, they'd make sure that the hog was first made sterile. Now, Daniel came there, he outwitted them by taking a newborn hog. They never suspected that this would be raised to an older age and then reproduced. In any event, he outwitted the Egyptians. We do not credit the Egyptians with any brains, of course, Chas v'Shalom. Doesn't take much to outwit them. In this case of evil, though, he showed to Nebuchadnezzar he could fulfill his mission successfully. The point was, though, that it was the will of Hashem that Daniel should not be subjected to this test, because it would mean that since prior to this Nebuchadnezzar believed in him as an idol, the laws of an idol must be burnt would mean he's being thrown into the fire to have that law fulfilled. The Jews would expect him to be burnt. And therefore, in order to avoid that, he was sent out of Babel temporarily. We'll have this story continued in the next shiur.